Now this morning, we want to look at a panorama of the parenting process. Burton White, distinguished professor of child development at Harvard University, and unquestionably the leading authority in this field, extensive researcher, wrote a book that I would highly recommend to you. It's entitled The First 3 Years of Life, one of the most helpful and insightful resources you could get your hands on. And in that book, he makes a profound statement. This is the product of his extensive research in the process of parenting. In my judgment, not more than 1 out of 10 gets off to as good a start as he could in the parenting process. But given a little help, parents are capable of doing an excellent job. Unfortunately, help is often not available. Ladies and gentlemen, our society does not educate its citizens in parenting. I don't know of a course called Parenting 101 that you can enroll in the average university. You can have children without ever having a certificate of qualification. And the unfortunate thing is that you become involved in the most important of human relationships. And yet the one remaining profession left to the amateur. This morning, Gene and I would like to give you some help. We are convinced that many a parent has his or her ball lost in the parental weeds because they do not have the big picture. They've lost their perspective. They're so involved in the day-by-day activities of parenting that they don't have the big picture. We believe parenting is best understood in terms of 3 major divisions. And we're going to spell these out for you. You have some notes that will help you in the process. First of all, as we saw last night, God brings a man and a woman together in a contractual relationship. Remember, the greatest impact upon their marriage is the family from which they have come. You see, it would be relatively easy if both of them came from the same kinds of families, with the same habit patterns, the same values, the same commitments. But they don't. This husband comes from a home very strict in its orientation. You turn around, you get nailed to the floor. This woman comes from a home that's loose as a goose. Permissive. You want to throw a brick through a plate glass window? Throw it through. We don't want to curb your genius for throwing bricks. He comes from a home where, man, you've got to be on time, which being interpreted means 5 minutes before the event. She comes from a home, if we get there, it's a miracle. He comes from a home where they get up early in the morning. You know, they're the morning doves. She comes from a home, who knows when they're going to get up. And even when they get up, they can't function. Three cups of coffee, 9:30 in the morning before her second brain cell comes on. These make for fascinating adjustment. Then into that family come some children, perhaps 3 of them. to a girl's a boy. But just the constellation of that family is very important in terms of its dynamic. Was that last girl a wanted girl? Or did they really want a boy? And when she came, what a disappointment. Or perhaps that second pregnancy blew mom clean out of the saddle because obviously it was not planned. And maybe the child is rejected. You need to know that rejection is communicated in the womb of a mother. We've got some of the most fantastic research that's been done in the last 5 to 10 years. My daughter has been right in the heart of the whole process, and the more you study it, the more you realize how important it is for this husband and this wife to get their act together before those children come along. I'm not talking about two perfect people. I'm talking about two progressing people. Two people, both of whom have problems. Both of whom have potential. And the problems of the person becomes the problems of the partnership. And the potential of the persons become the potential of the partnership. And if they build their marriage on the basis of their strengths, they've got double advantages. If they build their marriage on the basis of their weaknesses, they'll tear it apart. And people are getting divorced every single day of the week on the basis of 10 to 15% of a good marriage that is weak. I had a man in my office some time ago. He said, "I want out." I said, "Why do you want out?" "Oh," he said, "you know, you should know what I'm married to." Well, I said, "What are you married to?" And he unloaded the truck. And I was taking some notes. And after I get through, I said, "Now let me see, this is what she's got going against her, is that right?" He said, "That's right, and a lot more." I said, "You know, I can't believe that an intelligent, perceptive individual like you would have ever married a woman like that." "So, well, she wasn't that way when I married her." "Oh," I said, "really? Then you made her that way." You know, by now he's wondering if he should have ever showed up to see me. And I sent him on a project. I said, "How much of your marriage do you think is really bad?" "Oh," he said, "man, 10%, 15%. I said, "All right, I want you to go back and find out what you got going for you in your marriage." He came back with a list that was the most impressive list he had ever seen. He said, "I changed my mind." I said, "Why did you change your mind?" He said, "It suddenly dawned on me how stupid I was, that I was willing to tear up a marriage that had 85 to 90% of it going for me, for the 10 or 15 that needed improvement." It happens all the time. Because if you focus upon your weakness as a husband, your weakness as a wife, you lose your perspective. Furthermore, if you are not in the process of solving these problems, then you are going to project them upon the next generation, which will in turn become partners. And as Harold Voth, senior psychiatrist at Menninger Clinic, wrote in his excellent book, The Castrated Family, the problem in America today is that we've got sick people developing sick families, which in turn develop sick people, and we've set up a cycle. Now, the three divisions, just for convenience, are childhood from birth through age 11. Adolescence, 12, generally speaking, thought of as through 22, 24. Some are now pushing it later to marriage whenever that takes place. And by the way, if you've got a kid who's 24, 25, 26, 27, don't get bent out of shape because they're not married. Every year over 26, the potential for a good marriage becomes phenomenal. And one of the problems in our society is a lot of kids are marrying too young. It's sort of a game of Russian roulette. They really don't know their partner. They're really not mature enough to move into a marriage. And finally, the period most overlooked, the period of adulthood. Very little written on that subject. Very little research that has been done. See, most of us think, man, if I could ever get those kids through high school, get them off to college, get them out of my hair, get them married, we'd solve all of our problems. Then I could retire. Gene and I will tell you, with four marriage children, then it really gets exciting. You have just begun, and some of the most significant parenting you will ever do in your life, you will do when your children are grown, if you know how to parent during that period of time. And we'd like to share with you some things about it. Let's just give you an overview so that you can jot something down there in your notes. Remember that the period of childhood is primarily the period of instruction. As the Bible says, line upon line, precept upon precept, here a little, there a little. It's a building process. And the most important input you can have to a child takes place during the first 11 years. But then a switch comes. And those of you who've gone through this know what I'm talking about. When you get to adolescence, my friend, you either develop a sense of humor or you go neurotic. And a person's confidence as a parent is in direct proportion to the age of their children. First 11 years, yeah, no problems. I don't even know why we have this parenting conference here. You know, and all of a sudden, the kids hit grief. Up until now, you were the authority. You knew everything. Now, you know nothing. You know, what was it like to be on the ark, Mom? And your parenting role drastically changes. Now it's not primarily instruction, it is primarily internalization. That is, the child has got to go through the process where all that I have been exposed to becomes my personal property. So I do this not because my father says so, or not because my mother told me not to do it, but because this is my conviction. This is where I stand. These are my values. These are my commitments. And then the last period, we are calling the period of interdependence. You need to understand it's a two-way street. It's not only you ministering to your children, it's your children ministering to you. And that, of course, is built on the basis of relationship. One more thing, and Gene will come to share with you what goes on during childhood. What are you doing? What are your objectives? Between each of these three relationships, childhood, adolescence, and adult, there is a cause-effect relationship. In other words, what you do during childhood will largely determine what he or she does during adolescence. And what they do during adolescence will determine largely what the both of you do during adulthood. Now, childhood.
Here is Edward Bear coming downstairs now, bump, bump, bump on the back of his head. It is, as far as he knows, the only way of coming downstairs. But sometimes he feels there really is another way. If only he could stop bumping for a moment and think of it. And then he feels that perhaps there isn't. Anyhow, some of you mommies and daddies will recognize that as a quotation by A.A. Milne, the introduction to Winnie the Pooh. And I'm using it as an illustration this morning because there are many of us who either have bumped our own heads down the steps and think that possibly that's the only way of coming down, or we are dragging our children, bump, 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 down the steps, and are not taking time to think, is there a better way? Childhood, as Howie has defined, roughly from the 0 to 11 year mark, is a time of discovery. It's a time of input. It is a time of absorption. I made reference last night to Dr. Maria Montessori, who has opened our eyes probably more than any other person to the factor of a child opening up like a tiny little rosebud and absorbing all of his surroundings. I think possibly her most dramatic illustration is that of language, how children will absorb 2, 3 languages simultaneously. They do not study the grammar, but they absorb it and they don't get it mixed up. That's the way the human mind is programmed. And children are amazing and they're brilliant in those early months and years. There are 3 components of childhood that we will look at. First, the attitudes, which leads into habit patterns, which then eventuates into relationships. Howie's already made reference to Dr. Burton White of Harvard. He's written some very troubling, unsettling material concerning attitudes. Don't let this scare you, but listen to this. Informal education that families provide for their children makes more of an impact on a child's total educational development than the formal educational system. To begin to look at a child's educational development when he is 2 years of age is already much too late, particularly in the area of social skills and attitudes. And most of us read that and say, well, that's why should we go on? I mean, we've already flunked the course. But he goes on to qualify. But let's back up a minute. He also says this, that he does not believe that a child can be spoiled in the first 7 months of life. And this has been reinforced by many other studies and research material, that a small baby needs very much to be cuddled and hugged and held and shown affection during those first 7 to 8 months of life. This is where basic attitudes really begin, in the little child's consciousness. Dr. White says that once a child reaches 2 years, primary social orientation has been established, and it's increasingly difficult to alter that. For example, if a child has been taught that the world revolves exclusively around him, that if he simply insists on having his way, that all resistance will crumble, then he will be predisposed to operating in a self-centered fashion for all of his subsequent relationships. However, this does not mean that he cannot be changed. What we need to know is that those early days are extremely important in setting the attitudinal course of the child. How does one do this? As a Christian, what do we do with this little infant in our home in order to provide the proper attitudinal setting? I like the conclusions of Dr. Virginia Satir. She's an eminent family therapist, and she has set out the environmental factors that she thinks are really important for forming good, positive attitudes. A home, number one, where self-worth is high. We'll talk about the development of self-worth in a moment. 2, where communication is specific, clear, direct, and honest. When we speak to our children, even when they're very, very young, we should be specific and very clear so that they can interpret what we say. Then the rules in the home, she says, should be flexible, human, appropriate. We must have rules, but they need to be understood by the child. And lastly, the linking to society for the child should be hopeful and open. Not the fact that we are squeezed into a terrible and a dangerous world and we have to pull ourselves in on ourselves, but that we need to open ourselves up to the world, a hopeful attitude toward the world. We need also to know that the development of this child is key in those early years. This comes from Dr. Louise Kaplan, a physician who has done a lot of study of this little developing infant, and she's written a big tome of a book called Oneness and Separateness. But her whole thesis, which has sort of revolutionized my whole idea of child development, is that we go through cycles of oneness and separateness all of our lives. We begin with a feeling of oneness. It is very blissful and harmonious before we are born. Then there is that first separation of birth. It's a painful thing for a child, as we all know. But there is still that closeness with the mother. At 5 months, approximately, there comes that first awareness of the mother's presence out there. There's something other than me. And then at approximately 12 months, the child begins to move away. And you know how the little one-year-old is joyful and abandoned and absolutely seeming without a care in the world. But as he begins to develop, about a year and a half, you see anger and sadness beginning to come into that child's attitudes, because he recognizes that the mother is apart and there's a certain turmoil, and he is seeking the conditions of love in his life. He goes back and forth between these two. About 3 years, he achieves an initial sense of reconciliation. That is, he can approve of the fact that mother and others are out there, and that I am here and I am me. And so this sense of well-being begins to develop by, as she says, having built up inside himself enough of good mother and good me that I can continue functioning as a separate individual, even though I may have angry and hateful thoughts toward myself, toward my parents, and I might add, toward God, because our children's attitude toward God comes largely from what he thinks of his parents. Now, that's a big dose, and we need to think that through. But these early attitudes come from the feeling toward himself. Now, what does the Christian parent do? How do we develop these? I don't want to seem to oversimplify, but I want to share with you something that has been helpful to me over the years. I have taken the verse, Galatians 5:22, which is kind of a description of the fruit of the Spirit that Paul writes to the Galatians. And you remember there he lists 9 characteristics. And I have made that kind of a personal checklist for myself as a mother. I've divided it into 3. They're 3, 3, and 3. You know, everybody knows the first 3. Love, joy, and peace. Now, these are inward intangibles. I cannot teach my 2-year-old child about peace. But these must be demonstrated in my life in order that the child will pick up this attitude. They do pick it up from their elders, from those who are closest to them. And so there must be outward evidence of love in my life. That is, what communicates to a child? Well, he's born with 5 senses, and he feels, and he sees, and he hears. And so there has to be that touching of the child, that speaking to the child, that cuddling, that kissing, that a child craves when he's very, very young. The joy, I don't say we're just going to be happy today, because the child may, I don't want to be happy today. But I must exude the joy with smiles, with light inflections in my voice, with laughing. Now, children will not always accept this. I recall very well an incident which I think I told in this very auditorium of my 2 sons who were sharing a bedroom, and younger one was sleeping in the bottom bunk bed, the older one was up on the top, and it was my custom to go in and to kiss them goodnight every night. And when Bob, our older son, had reached the age of, 10, 11, whatever it was, one night, just out of the blue, he pushed me away when I was trying to kiss him goodnight and said, "Oh, Mom, that's kid stuff." Now, I could have remonstrated with him, lectured him on how important and, well, all the rest, but I knew instinctively that that was a waste of time. So I just sort of gave him a loving little pat and said, okay, and I went ahead and kissed Bill goodnight and went on my way. For months that went on. Every night I would go in, kiss Bill goodnight, and maybe squeeze Bob's big toe or something and say goodnight, realizing that at that moment he could not handle that emotion. And then, months later, maybe more than a year, one night as I went in and was kissing Bill goodnight, I heard this voice upstairs, and it was crack, it was changing. And I remember it sort of cracked when he said, Mom, you forgot somebody up here. He had come to the place where he again wanted to resume that show of affection. And I needed to be able to do that little two-step with him, to step in when he needed it, to step back when he couldn't handle it. That is part of the development of the attitudes. And with that comes the habit patterns. The habit patterns are more complex. These are sequences of attitudes, if you will. Another very astute student of children is Dr. Uri Bronfenbrenner of Cornell. He's done some excellent work, especially internationally. He has written a book called The Two Worlds of Childhood, where he compares Russian children and American. And he comes to this conclusion that children learn, these are habits, by watching others. Imitation is its own reward. And he shows and quotes other men who have studied it. The child takes on the actions of the model without visible inducement or compulsion. Nobody tells the child to imitate. He just imitates. The model can influence the child's behavior in two ways. First, by doing something that the child has never experienced before. That's the new patterns. And then secondly, by doing something that is new in the child's repertoire, or what we call the old, the reinforcement. And this is the most important, he says. And this is what parents do over and over again. And because we are parents, parents are the most determinative in habit formation. These sequences, let's take, for example, the bedtime routine. What do you go through? Well, there's a kiss, there's a hug, there's a story, there's a song, there's a drink of water, on and on. It becomes a habit pattern, and sometimes it gets to be a very long habit pattern. And the child expects that. He's comfortable with it. It is learned, he says, in small bits, in the components. And, remind you, it is also unlearned that way. When we have to unlearn habit patterns, we have to take it apart bit by bit. He may be a chip off the old block, but transmission, says Dr. Bronfenbrenner, cannot take place without the active participation of the older generation. And this is what's important. If children have contact only with their own age mates, there is no possibility for learning culturally established patterns of cooperation and mutual concern. You know that's true in church. If you send your child only to the junior church, he does not learn the habit patterns of the adult church. It's important that children be put in a multi-age setting so that they learn, what does grandma think? What does that elderly gentleman or that middle-aged woman next door think? So that he can move into the cultural patterns of the world in which he lives. And he lives, and not just with his little kindergartners or elementary school people, whatever it happens to be. But possibly the most long-reaching thing that a child learns in those first 11 years is the matter of relationships. This is the reaching out to other people. And it is here that he expresses what he has learned in terms of his self-image. What I think of myself determines very much how I relate to other people. I mentioned to you earlier the nine parts of Galatians 5:22. If I have internalized or learned, I will not internalize as much until I get to the teen years, but in those early years, if I have learned attitudes where I am comfortable with love and with peace in my life, where patience and goodness and kindness has been expressed to me, people have listened to me, and that's how a parent expresses it. I sit down and take time with my child. By my facial expressions, I say to that little one, I really want to hear what you have to say. I really am for you. I may not condone what you did, but I am for you as an individual. That's what tells. But I really earned my parental stripes on those last three: faithfulness, goodness, self-control. If I am the faithful, reliable parent, I'm always there when the child needs me. He knows I'm not perfect, but he knows that Mom is really there with him in heart, and that she is going to be a gentle person. She's not going to treat me harshly and even emotionally toss me out. She is a controlled person. Every physical, emotional, and intellectual movement that my parent shows to me is under the control of the Holy Spirit. If he sees that for 11 years, then when he relates to other people, he has developed a sense of belonging, a sense of worth, a sense of confidence, which is the big three in the triad of developing his self-image. He's been allowed to express anger. He's been allowed to test the limits, but always in this controlled atmosphere. Then he reaches out to other people. His attachment bond, you see, is secure, and he can explore the world outside, and he can be comfortable in it. But a good home background can immunize the child against that debilitating effect of group contagion. I think the thing that we fear the most when it comes to teenage is the group, the peer group. And it is the home which does immunize the child against that negative influence. This is exactly what the book of Proverbs says. If proper attitudes are instilled, good habits are formed, then relationships will follow more easily. But these skills of communicating, sharing, and separating from the childhood, the infancy, in a positive manner, are what tell the story in the teen years. Dr. Paul Meyer, who's written a book on Christian child rearing, tells us that 85% of the adult personality is already formed by the sixth birthday. Now, you're looking at our core, but we're going to emphasize that the grace of God moves in and reworks this. But this is the main flow of a child's formation. So that we as parents need to teach our children in those early years the identification, who he is and what it means to be a man or a woman. That's why the child needs to identify with an adult of the same sex. The communication has developed a self-worth. He's listened to. He can say what he needs to say. He has developed a budding conscience. He can understand the truth of Acts 16:31, the gospel of Jesus Christ. He needs to get that firmly in his mind during those first 11 years. It's understandable to him. And he has lived in a world that has been created as a beneficial home atmosphere. He's had family devotions. He's had good music around him. He's had shopping trips with a parent that explains the principles of why we do what we do, buy and don't buy what we do. And then he's been exposed to the church at large. He's had other Christian people to impinge upon his life so that when he reaches this crucial period of the adolescence, he is ready to meet that world. He has something built up inside of him.
During adolescence, there are four primary things that you do for your child. We'll put them all under the letter D. It will be easier for you to remember. First of all, the process of discovery. Secondly, the process of development. Third, the process of determination. And fourth, the process of decision-making that sometimes falls. Let's look at these in detail. First of all, the process of self-discovery. Every child goes through a period of time when he has to answer the question, who am I? He's got to know that he or she is a unique individual. And this is what we frequently call the identity crisis. And by the way, if you are an individual who is well known in your particular field, you are Dr. So-and-so, you are the lawyer in the community, you are the elder in the church, then this process is complicated. Every one of my four children had a severe identity crisis. I learned this early on when I started working with professional athletes, because the moment I would meet their wife, they would introduce themselves by saying, you know, I'm Carmen, I'm Sally. But they'd never tell me their last name, because the only identity they had was their relationship to their husband. And this is exactly what a teenager goes through. Secondly, there is the control of emotions toward parents, toward peers, toward the opposite sex, toward authority figures. And this is why it is so important for you to give a child freedom, as we shall see in the decision-making process. But third, and I think most important, is the stage of the acquisition of models. Every adolescent goes through a period of time when nobody knows less than my parents. Wonderful people, but... And what you are looking for is someone outside of your home who is in league with your home and supportive of your values and your convictions. To me, the greatest tragedy in many a Christian home is that they are so turned in upon themselves. And by the way, it's intensifying. We are so blown out by our society that we run to our home and we treat it like a hole and we hide in there and pull it all in. Your home should be filled with significant persons to whom your children are being exposed. Because never forget, in the culture, by the testimony of the pagans themselves, the pedestals are empty. Met a little kid in a barber shop some time ago that I have known for some time, and I said, son, who do you want to be like? He said, mister, I ain't found nobody I want to be like. You think he's an exception? I got news for you. The average young person, 25, 26, 27, who is single, is desperately looking for men and women just like you as models. What does it mean to be a Christian husband? What does it mean to be a Christian wife? A lot of these kids have no idea. And fourth and finally, this is the period for decision making. There are four major decisions every young person must make. First of all, he must make a decision concerning his career. That is, how's he going to spend the rest of his life? What's he going to do for a living, for a ministry? Secondly, he deals with a problem of courtship. Who is the person with whom I am going to spend the rest of my life? Third, he deals with companionships. This is the period of friend forming, that strong peer relationship. And finally, it's the period in which your convictions are set in firm ground, so that I come to the place where I ask, what am I committed to? I would strongly suggest you get a copy of Pat's book. She graciously gave me a copy last night. I could hardly put it down. It's loaded with the most practical stuff, particularly during those adolescent periods. Have you hugged your teenager today is the title. Get a copy, because it will surface for you a lot of the details of what we are trying to paint with a broad brush stroke.
Now, the adult years are characterized by three components. This is high altitude flying. There's very little written on what we do as children and parents in the adult years. We've characterized it as autonomy. He's on his own. Accessibility. He should be in touch. And vulnerability. At risk. The Bible says that, in the words of Adam, therefore shall a man leave. there comes a time when a child is to separate from his home. And that goes for the girl as well. Adulthood is reached, and there's a time of separation. The child feels it normally. The parent should feel it normally. And as Howie made reference last night, it's not always easy. I've hurt each time one of my children has had to leave home. But I know that it's the normal thing. I want to take some biblical illustrations because, as I say, there's very little written on this. We have to let go, and what happens when we let go? First of all, this child is on his own, and I would use the illustration of Moses. Now, I know that Moses was quite an older man when he separated from his father-in-law, Jethro, but he had to, in order to do what God wanted him to do, is to leave physically Midian, go to Egypt, and he had to make a separation. It was also a spiritual thing, if you read the record. He had to depend upon God, make his own decisions, become a self-directed person. And this is what we plan and train our children to do. So that hopefully each one of you as an adult sitting here is a self-directed person. When your child reaches that point, you need to let that child go. Letting go does not mean that you stop caring. It does mean that you love at a distance. It doesn't mean that you cut yourself off, but the realization that you can't control that other one anymore. It's not to care for, it's to care about. It's not to fix anything for that child who's an adult. It's to be supportive of that individual. Not to be protective any longer, but to permit that adult to face reality. Secondly, there must be an accessibility. I look at the example biblically of Naomi and Ruth. Here was a young woman, Ruth, and she had access to this woman, Naomi. She had so far to come. She was a proselyte, but because Naomi was willing to share with Ruth her son, her home, her faith, her family, you read the record in the book of Ruth about how she returned this all back to her mother. The women of Bethlehem said, "Your daughter loves you and is better to you than seven sons." Because Naomi was accessible to this girl, and she needed it. There needs to be, as we say, an interdependence, and some of us need to think this through on our own personal basis with our own parents who want to be accessible to us, and we tend to pull away and say, "I don't need you anymore." Yes, you do. We need each other. And lastly, and this is an idea perhaps some of you haven't thought about, there is a vulnerability in that adult-to-adult relationship. There is a transition that takes place. In my book, Afternoon, I quoted Irma Bombeck because it's a very light but very telling little section where she talks about how the mother becomes the child as she becomes older. We who are adults need to fade in a sense and let that adult child make those decisions and begin to parent us. See, that's why we have so many lonely old people who are often retirement centers or places far from their children, because we don't have this interdependence. There's a feeling of antipathy between them. So that as this transition takes place, the parent-child needs to become an adult-to-adult relationship. I no longer tell him how it was, but I discuss with him and ask on a peer level. The lecture period is over. We simply talk on a par with each other. There is mutual respect or lack of respect, and that is what comes home to roost. Aging parents desperately need their children. The ugly truth is that we can't do too much about the jaundiced individual who is now old and is now estranged. What we can do is to train our own children so that as they grow up, they know that we love them, we depend upon them, we trust them. And then, as we grow older, They will be ministering to us and will be teaching their children that this is the way God intended from generation to generation.
We've tried to paint for you an overview of the process of childhood, adolescence, and adulthood as a parent. But so what? What does all of this mean? We'd like to share with you several principles that you can jot down, use as a basis for your discussion, and then weave them into the fabric of your life. The one thing this tells us and teaches us is that one cannot determine what he receives as a person, only how he responds. You didn't determine to have these parents. You didn't determine that these parents split and took off and left you, perhaps in the care of another one. We cannot determine a lot of the things that happen to us, but we can determine how we respond. We can either blame somebody else or we can change ourselves. You see, you can't change what has been done to you, but you can change what you do. I came out of a broken home. I know what it is to cry myself asleep at night, never knowing where I would wake up the next day. And I can remember, particularly in the growing up process, running into all kinds of individuals who came from a growth situation just like mine, but who have spent the rest of their life blaming their parents that this happened, and deteriorating as the years go by. I repeat, you can't determine what has been done to you, but you can determine what you are going to do. And that's the most hopeful thing in all of the world. Second, the greatest impact on your marriage is your parental home. Now think that through for a minute. If that's true, then you need to remember that your home is now making its greatest impact upon your children's marriage. The Chinese have an incredible proverb that I think is freighted with meaning. They say, you cannot determine your success as a parent until your children finish their parenting role. It's kind of fun to watch the only granddaughter we have right now, just one of our children in the parenting process, because I kid you not, she blows Jean and me clean out of the water. They are doing a far superior job than we ever thought of doing. See, ladies and gentlemen, I am convinced we are selling our kids down the river. They are perfectly capable, as Burton White said, but somebody's got to take some time to teach them and hopefully model to them. The third thing that this says to us is that the greatest means of strengthening the marriage of your child is to strengthen your own marriage. By the way, that's the greatest contribution you will make to your children. There is no greater heritage than the realization my mother and my father are incurably and unashamedly in love with each other. What a security. Yeah, but there's somebody out there, in fact, there are a couple dozen of you, who say, I'm the only parent. My partner deserted me, divorced me, died, and now I'm left with several children. Or I think I hear someone out there married who says, this is all great, but my husband is not involved in the process. He could care less. Or my wife is out to lunch, And I've got tremendous convictions and values, and she has them about priority 27 on a list of 25. You know, I was doing some research the other day in a quite different area, and I ran across Skousen's book, So You Want to Raise a Boy. Some of you, I'm sure, have read it about 20, 25 years ago, an oldie. And it almost jarred me when I read the statement. Sociologists have pointed out that when a brood of children lose their father, they nearly always lose their mother, too. Usually she has to get a job, and the entire family must somehow limp along under far less than ideal conditions. Such a family can be a success, however, and usually is. But it takes a truly great woman to serve the double role of both father and mother. Such circumstances call for as much encouragement and help as possible from the church, community agencies, friends, and neighbors. It's surprising how many leaders and outstanding personalities have come from widowed mothers. But whenever this happens, it's usually because a mother was willing to go the extra mile, sometimes many extra miles, to make up for the handicap of a missing father. And I stopped dead in my tracks because the middle of my research was the fact that some of the most significant children and marriages in our generation are coming out of single-parent homes. It first hit me as a professor at the seminary, as I began to move into the life of guys and gals on the campus that were a breed apart. And I said, I'll bet you come from a strong family. And often they'd say, well, that depends how you define it, Prof. My father left when I was 3, and my mother reared the 6 of us. Or perhaps a guy who would say to me, as I would see such high-level qualities in terms of leadership, no, I never had a father, Prof. He deserted us early on. My mother reared us. We have 5 young men, 5 of the finest we have ever had in our institution, all the product of one home with one mother and a father that went home to be with a Savior very early on. You see, what we're trying to tell you, my friend, is that there's hope. And that leads us to the last principle I want to share with you. And that is, this panorama gives great hope for a marriage, for a family, if there is an invasion of the supernatural. You see, there are many of you who are realistically plugged in to the fact that this person is not there, and he probably never will be. Interestingly enough, increasing at a very rapid rate is this woman. That a dear friend of mine in Dallas called me on Tuesday of this week. He said, I came home from work, my wife left a note on the table and said, you can pick up the kids, you won't see me again. And he's left with 4 children. Now, are these people second-class citizens? You know, are they doomed to mediocrity the rest of their life? By the way, if you read a lot of secular psychologists, sociologists, and other researchers, they will tell you you are. In fact, Burton White will just absolutely dissolve you, and he's got all of the evidence, because for the most part, he's talking about a pagan society with no invasion of the supernatural. Let me tell you what God did in my life. My parents were separated, really, before I knew anything about it. I went to live with my parental grandfather, grandmother. My grandfather was an alcoholic. I used to spend my time as a boy in Philadelphia, going from tavern to tavern, seeing if I could find him, picking up a few pretzels en route to take the paycheck out of his back pocket before he drank it all away so we would have something to eat. See, I know what it is to come home to a drunken grandfather begging his wife for a gun to end his life. And I grew up in that kind of an environment. But this dear woman came to Jesus. I'm sure she couldn't have passed an elementary theological examination. She just incarnated Jesus Christ. It wasn't until down during this period of childhood when a guy by the name of Walt, a Sunday school teacher, moved into my life and led me to Jesus Christ. It was the easiest assignment he ever had because my grandmother, invaded by the supernatural, made Walt's relationship with me and his presentation of the gospel totally creditable. And during my adolescence, the latter part of it, I met an incredible woman who moved into my life and gave me the pleasure of four of the finest kids you'd want to see, who also were the invasion of the supernatural. See, many times we're here at a parenting conference thinking of what we're going to do for our kids. I get news for you. You got to start thinking of what your kids are going to do for you. In fact, already what they've done. You wouldn't be worth a dime without the particular kids that God gave you. So stop asking, Lord, why did you give me this one? That's a part of his curriculum. That's his means of molding and shaping you and forming you into the image of Christ. That's another evidence of the invasion of the supernatural. Oh, you say, but I remember in the Ten Commandments, Moses said God's going to visit the sin to the third and fourth generation. Parents sinning, children guilty. You misread it. That is not what it said. It says that God is going to visit the sins and of the father with respect to children who hate him. If the child follows the pattern of the father, it will go on from generation to generation. That's the potential. But to thousands of generations, he is going to minister his grace. And we've never had that many generations in human history. And it's the grace of God, my man, my woman friend, that's reached and penetrated into your life and brought you to the Savior. And you may be in the midst of a very tragic situation, a very difficult assignment. And it's easy for those of us with whom God has been so gracious to get super pious. And I would not ever want to convey that message to you. We are on your team. We are supporting of you. And we are praying during this weekend that the grace of God will move into your experience, your difficult situation, whatever it is, and reproduce Jesus Christ in your life.